being here, and I think, Vu, we can start to get started and welcome folks.
Yeah. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. I am Vu Le. I use he, him pronouns, and I am calling in from Seattle, which is on Duwamish and Coast Salish land. And for colleagues who are blind or have low vision, I am a mid-aged Asian man with short salt and pepper hair and glasses and a pervasive aura of like vegan sexiness combined with existential angst right now. So that's what I have. Hildy, how about you?
I can't beat that. I absolutely can't beat that. I am Hilde Gottlieb. It is a joy to be with you all today and with you, Vu. I am in the traditional unceded lands of the Tonawatam people and the Pascua-Yaqui, which is colonially known as Tucson, Arizona. Sort of the opposite of you, Vu. You're in rainy north. I'm in very, very sunny south. I am a oh, what do they call it? A woman of a certain age. I think that's between middle age and death, is a woman of a certain age, with short dark hair, calming blue eyes, and very long earrings.
Awesome.
And
Well, thank
I don't purport that anybody has the sexiness you do, Vu, so.
Thank you, Hildy. Well, thanks for joining us. Hildy and I just want to have just a very casual conversation today. And so we have 90 minutes, but we're hoping to talk for about 45 minutes. And I know some folks have to go maybe on the hour mark, but if you want to stay for longer, please feel free to stay until 11:30 AM PT today. Why don't we get started with how do we know each other, Hildy? Like I kind of forgot. How do we meet?
I think Andrea introduced us, saying that we needed to know each other. I know, I'm pretty sure it was Andrea, John Smith, but we were introduced by somebody that said, "I can't believe you two don't know each other. You need to know each other." And it's been, I don't remember how long. I know you've been on our board for however long, 4 years, 5 years. So it's been a long time, but I just always love our conversations.
Yeah, it's been really fun. And I've been thinking about a lot of the stuff that you've taught me that I still use. For example, like we were talking a while ago about what makes good writing, and you were like, think about the things that piss you off and make a list of all the things that you're just angry about. And that's been very helpful. I think a lot of my writing, I just rant about all the things that piss me off. And I think a lot of us are just really pissed off right now, right? So I appreciate you, Hildy, and I'm glad to have this conversation. So let's talk about this nonprofit rut we are in, because I feel like honestly, I've been talking about how we've been like unicorns, right? And we've been trying to make the world better. And we use unicorn magic, which is expected of us, just perform miracles on these limited resources. And for a long time, that's what we've been doing. And now I kind of feel like we're like this unicorn here with this broken horn. Like it's just one of my kids played with it and it's just like snapped down. Right. So what is going on? Like, do you feel this way? Why is it normal to feel this way? Is it new?
No, the work that Dimitri and I have been doing for over 30 years has been working with nonprofits in a variety of different ways. We've founded nonprofits, the one we're in right now, but also others, which I can talk about a little bit later. We've been consultants to nonprofits, and it's been about 30 years ago that we realized that there was a massive frustration throughout the sector and globally. I mean, it's not just in the US that we noticed it 30 years ago. I'm going to guess that it's been longer than that. And the frustration is that we sense that we can accomplish so much more and that something is stopping us. And it's real easy to point to money that's stopping us. And it's real easy to point to boards. If only we had a better board, if only we had more money. But what we found is that people would get all the money, they'd get a better board, and they were still frustrated. And so we took a lot of time to just dig into where is this frustration coming from? And we noticed a couple things. One, I'm gonna share with y'all, which is why we focus on questions here at Creating the Future. That we're asking counterproductive questions and answering them. and our work is answering them. But a big piece of it, Vu, and you asked, is it normal?
Wait a second, Hilda. I'm sorry. Some of our colleagues saying that you might sound a little quiet. Is there a way to raise your volume? I want to make sure that people can hear you, and or maybe you can just yell at the screen.
I will speak louder. I don't know why. Let me tested my mic before and let me output level. Let's make me. All right, is that helping any?
Oh, that sounds way better. Yeah.
Okay,
I agree.
cool. Thank you guys for letting me know.
Yeah,
Thank you.
so the questions, what are these questions that people have been asking that have
Well,
been?
the core of it is that all of the systems that we rely upon in nonprofit work, none of them were actually intended for what we use them for. So let's go back to thousands of years ago. Church charity was all about helping one individual at a time. The religious institution, doesn't matter which one. Religious institution decided who was deciserving, decided what they were deserving of, what they received, and helped one group or one family at a time. Fast forward a couple thousand years, what do we do in our programs? We help one person at a time. We decide who's deserving. They fill out applications. We decide what they're deserving of. We get strategic planning straight out of the military. Napoleon invented strategic planning.
Wait, no. Napoleon invented strategic planning? Really?
Yes. Actually, the word, the root of strategy is stratego, which comes from the Greek meaning a general in the army. All of our strategy that we think of as nonprofit stuff and social change stuff comes right out of the military, as does this hierarchical way of operating. We certainly are military command and control. And then everything else we get out of the business world. So you've got church as authority, you've got military as authority, you've got business as authority. All of the structures that we are using to dismantle power and privilege come from power and privilege. And so why we're stuck is none of what we are doing. We come to this to create change. We all want to come to this to create change. The systems we are using are incapable of creating change because they were never intended for that.
Okay, that is super depressing. can we get the chat back on? Is does
I
anyone
think
know how to do that here?
Dimitri is working on that.
I think it's
Yeah,
working.
thanks, Dimitri. Yeah, thanks for your patience, everyone. Please continue to use the chat for your
If
during
somebody
the
wants to test
Q&A.
it, I think it's on. And so hopefully we
No, I
will.
don't think it's on still.
That is very
But while we're
frustrating.
working on that, that sounds really depressing. All these strategies and things that we've been doing for years and apparently for decades now, have just been maintaining the status quo. But I am not so sure that that's necessarily true for across the board, right? Or across the different ideologies. It seems like conservative movements, right-wing movements have been extremely effective in this sort of the strategicness, right? Where they want to create this sort of like world, and they've been very effective at it.
Because they're asking different questions than we're asking. And I can share a little bit as we go along. It really comes down to what we realized when we had this aha years ago about the fact that everybody was frustrated. What we started doing was we started asking our clients different questions. We were consultants at the time. We started asking our clients different questions. And what we basically, I wish I could tell you that these were very research-based and very evidence-based, and I'm sorry, they're not. It was all, let's ask questions and see what happens. And so when we asked questions that led people to be their most creative selves, their most strategic selves, their most wise selves, we kept asking those questions. And when we asked questions that led people to fear and scarcity and that'll never work, We stopped asking those questions. And so the framework of catalytic thinking really comes out of that trial and error, is realizing that, oh, this series of questions leads us to our very, very best selves, leads to what is possible. And let's stop asking these questions that don't lead to that. What conservatives have done, and I'll answer it a little bit more when we get into some of what the questions are, but what they have done is they've taken advantage of some of the questions that actually lead to change. We can do the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. Apologies, everyone, for the technical issues with the chat. It seems like we can't really enable this without restarting the webinar. In the meanwhile, no one can actually see the question and answers that everyone else is doing, but there's like 300 and 15 questions and comments right now. And actually, about 1,700 people registered for this webinar. So apologies, we couldn't get everyone in today, but I'm hoping we can continue this conversation. Maybe do a part two at some
Well,
point.
here's the deal. We are monitoring for those of the people in the room here, the ones who could fit into the Zoom room. You would have used the chat, but everybody else is watching this live streamed via our website. So what I want to suggest is everybody, if you've got comments and questions, use Twitter. I hate Twitter now, but use Twitter. Use the hashtag creating the future, and we will be monitoring that hashtag on Twitter. So if you can load Twitter, I really apologize, but if you can load Twitter, and use the hashtag creating the future, we will be monitoring that hashtag religiously. Dimitri is sitting next to me and he's monitoring it now. So we really, really appreciate your tech patience as we navigate this.
All right. So going back to what you were saying, what are so a question Polly is asking, what are these questions that conservatives have been asking that have led them to being so effective over the past several decades in particular?
I think it's important to understand why questions are so important. Oh, somebody just noted that the chat is back. Thank
Oh, thank
you,
goodness.
Dimitri.
Okay.
Thank you, Dimitri. It is
Okay, yay. Thank you so much, everyone, for your patience on this.
for your
This is way
patience.
better
You
because
know,
now
I.
we can actually see each other's comments, which I think is
You
really
know,
cool.
I have to share in when everybody started using Zoom during the pandemic, I saw this meme photo that just cracked me up. And it said that Zoom is like a seance, that you're all holding hands saying, I sense someone is trying to come into the room. Can you hear us? Can you see us? Are you there? And I just thought, yep, that's what our lives have become as we're all trying to navigate the technology here. I want to share a little bit about why questions are so important. And so let's start with that. And I'm going to share my screen to start. Oop, let me load that real quick. I rebooted my computer before we started. It really is a tech day, isn't it? It really is a tech day. All right, now we can go. I want to share why questions are so important. What is on the screen, and by the way, I will be sharing all the slides with you all. So you'll be getting all of these slides. What's on the screen is a flow chart with boxes and arrows saying this leads to that, that leads to that. What you can see in the second to the last box here is that we know that our actions create our results. I mean, that's a no-brainer. Nobody has to be told our actions create our results. What we don't think about often, though, is that it's our thinking that creates those actions. And so if we continually do the same actions and expect different results, you know, the definition of insanity. If we change the thinking that goes into those actions, then we'll start getting different results. Here's what the problem is, though. The problem is that What we do in the nonprofit world is we change our actions without changing our thinking. And here's what I mean by that. Funders are always asking us for a new program, right? They want to fund new initiatives, new, they want new doing. They're not rethinking what goes into that doing. They just want us to come up with something new to do. I mean, the whole meme of social innovation is all about doing something different, but we're not changing the thinking that goes into that doing. One of the things that occurred to us, it was a big aha for us, is that those assumptions and beliefs that are our thinking are actually the answers to questions we don't even realize we're being asked. So, a real easy example. I assume the world is flat, or I assume the world is round. The question is, what's going to happen if I go out there?
The world's actually a donut, so I don't know what you all are talking about. So it's a
I
donut.
always thought I always thought it was pretzels and the delicious bag of popcorn, but yeah. So I mean, it is. Yeah, somebody mentioned it's an everything bagel, and that is somebody who saw everything everywhere all at once, and I approve that it is definitely. But when we really think about our assumptions about what's possible, assumptions about who gets to make decisions, our assumptions about resources, that the key to changing those assumptions is to change the questions those assumptions are asking and answering. And because those questions are invisible, what we learned is that A, we got to first make them visible and then ask questions that actually lead us to what's possible, lead us instead of problem thinking. And I mean, what is the question that we're all asked every day in this world, in this business, in this work, is what is the problem and how will you solve it? And the difference between asking what is the problem and how will you solve it, and asking what is the future you want to create and what will it take to create that? You can feel physiologically, you can feel in your body the difference when I ask what's the problem versus what's the future you want to create. And that's what we started to do, is we started to focus only on the questions that bring out the very, very best in what we're capable of. And so that is our superpower. Our ability to create what's possible is our superpower. It is what differentiates us from all the other animals on the planet, including, I'm sorry, Vu, unicorns. You know, we have the ability to create something that we can't, that we've never seen. And our questions can help us do that. You know, you always talk to me about the power of movements. You've shared with me what that has made a difference for CCF.
Well, you've always talked about the power of movements, right? That's so I think maybe we can talk a little bit about this because I read an article about that you wrote about how we need to start thinking more about movement building versus kind of creating these organizations. In the United States, we have a lot of 501c3 organizations. And after a while, it seems like a lot of their mission become to maintain that 501c3 status versus actually solving the issue, creating the sort of future and then going out of business. And what I really appreciate about the movement and what has been influencing, I think when we started forming over here in Seattle with the community-centric fundraising movement, which was, we started formalizing this a few years ago, that article that you wrote about movements and about creating the future through movements and stuff. That was really influential for the CCF team because we read through this and we thought, you know what, we don't want to become a 501c3. We want community-centric fundraising to be a movement that spreads throughout the entire sector. And I think about like what would have happened if we had gone this traditional route. We had asked the same question, which is, what does it take for us to get money? What does it take for us to be able to be taken seriously in this sector? Right? That the same questions that would have led us to forming a 501c3 organization. CCF decided instead to ask these sort of like, what is the kind of future we want where fundraising is grounded in economic and social justice and is probably not even necessary at some point? And that led us to sort of creating this movement instead. And it's been really amazing to see how CCF has been going out there and spreading across the United States.
Yeah. Well, okay. So getting back to what we talked about earlier, this whole organization-centric model is modeled after businesses. Because it's not Pepsi's job to go out of business. It's Pepsi's job to sustain and create an organization that competes, that is better than Coke, that is, go down the list. It again is not modeled after what will create social change. In fact, think about those three that I mentioned: church and military and business. They don't want systemic change. They benefit from the system. And so again, movements are what have created change across time, but they're asking very, very different kinds of questions than they are, than we are. Where the questions they're asking about where to aim is not incremental. Movements aim at sweeping change. The questions that they ask about who gets to make decisions, everyone gets to make decisions. In our organizations, does everyone get to make decisions? When it comes to resources, they ask completely different questions. They build on what they have together. And so movements are just answering very, very different questions. We can ask and answer those same questions, though.
Karen is asking, can you describe in detail what is a movement? What is the difference between a movement versus like an organization?
Movement is a whole bunch of people who care about something, making something happen. Seriously.
Simplistic, but I think, right, but people might be able to say, well, that's also an organization. There's a whole bunch of people who care, and now they have a 501c3, so they get monies to work
It's
on whatever they're
it
creating.
is, but it's not a whole bunch of people. It's not permeable, it's not open, it's not anybody can come and go and anybody can make decisions, and it is not your organization is not 5 million people or 100,000 people descending on the streets. Your organization is an organization. It is a legally chartered thing. And a movement is emergent. It is natural. It is how nature works. It is yeah. And so it is really seriously change happening through people making decisions in their own lives and joining with other people. Now, can those become organizations? Without getting deeply into sociological geeky stuff, which is where I happen to love being, the reality is that movements that eventually become organizations tend to peter out. So the labor movement is a really, really big example of that. Once it became organized and became about the unions, that was when it was very easy to attack them and have them disappear. During the Reagan years, that happened. It's been happening over the past 30, 40 years because you've got a thing that you can counter and make it into the devil. But when you've just got thousands and thousands of people in the streets demanding change, that's a movement. Change basically doesn't happen because of organizations. Change happens in people's living rooms. Change happens where people change their minds, think about something, care passionately, and join with other people. And that's sort of what a movement is.
Why don't we have more movements then? Why are people so gravitating towards organizations?
Because we've set up the structures that make that the path. I mean, if you're going to create change, half the time somebody will say, that's a really cool idea. You should start a nonprofit because it's something you can do on your own. Okay. So if I've got an idea, I can go out, I can get three people to be on a board, and I can do it by myself. If I want to start a movement, I got to start talking to a whole lot of people and gathering people around me. And sometimes that leads to cults, which are sort of a kind of movement. But yeah, it's why it happens. Movements also happen more spontaneously. And that's a big piece of it is people getting together and saying, we just can't deal with this anymore. And it could be a small movement. It could be a movement for something in your community. It doesn't have to be hitting the streets about what's going on in the Middle East or what's going on with civil rights or gay rights.
Well, the chat is on fire right now, and people are like, well, we need movements because we need money and we need to pay ourselves. We need health insurance because the system, this is like this shitty system, ties our health insurance to our employment, right? That is horrible. And we just think that that's fine. And so
I don't know that we think it's fine. We just go along with it.
we
Once
just go along
again,
with
the
it, you know,
people with
all
power and
these.
privilege are the ones that create the systems that we're working under. And the only way, Vu, the only way that we have found is to change the questions that we are asking. The questions that movements are asking and answering are 180 degrees different than the questions that we are asking and answering inside our organizations. And those questions have to do with how we think about people, the assumptions and beliefs we have about people, the assumptions and beliefs we have about our purpose as an organization, and the assumptions and beliefs that we have about resources. And I can go into stuff about each of them, but we are the systems that we rely upon are asking and answering counterproductive questions. They're asking and answering the questions that military, church, and business would encourage us to ask. It's questions they ask and answer all the time, and it works for them. But it's not about creating systemic, long-term, visionary change. It's not about creating humane, equitable, healthy, vibrant, thriving communities. None of those, Coke is not about creating an equitable community. The military is not about creating a thriving community. And so what we can do as organizations to become more movement-like and to get to the point in your blog post about incrementalism, we can get past it because all of the systems that we are currently using are asking and answering questions that lead us directly to incrementalism, that lead us directly to being stuck.
All right, let's talk about incrementalism. And I, after talking to you about incrementalism, I've been noticing more of it. And I noticed it in myself too, because I feel like we just internalize it and we don't realize that we're doing it. You know, like for example, I think about all the stuff we have to put up with regarding grant writing. And you know, I think every year someone's like, why don't we get foundations to streamline their grant processes? Maybe they can go from a 10-page narrative to like a 5-page narrative. And other people go, yeah, that would be really great. And I start to think, yeah, that's really great. But then I start thinking, why do we even have grants? Like, why do we have grant applications? Why can't we just all have one grant application that we just send to funders and we don't tailor it to anyone, right? And then if we go beyond that, like why do we have foundations in the first place? I think about family foundation. I think how weird they are. Like, why do we have family? How is that even a thing? Right? So getting these family foundations to be like, well, we're gonna streamline this grant process to the question of like, why do you even exist? Like, what is going on with you? Why do a bunch of rich people get to hoard a bunch of money and then they and their family get to sit on this board and determine what to do with this money instead of just paying taxes, for example?
Well, and think about the fact that those are modeled after businesses that get to make those decisions. They get to keep their money. They get to do what they want with it. They get to lobby against taxes. They get to do all of that. But again, the first of all, you said you're noticing more and more of it. Once you start to notice something, you can't. This is one of those things you can't unsee. Once you start seeing incrementalism, and I want to share the three different sets of questions because they really focus in on how at every turn we are reinforcing that incrementalism, that we're only accomplishing this when we have the potential to accomplish this. And so the first one really gets to what you were talking about with the grants. And those are questions about people. And those questions really revolve around, and catalytic thinking really is just a framework of questions. It is just a list of questions. And I'm going to share some of the big conceptual questions with you all, but they obviously go deeper, and you can get more detail on the questions. But the first question about people is really who gets to decide? So, you're talking about grants and family foundations and all of that. Who gets to decide? And when we look inside our organization, so let me bring up the slides again here, see if I can. So the
Julia,
question,
I have to have the folks only see a black screen, so just
Well, I'm going to be reading
okay,
to
you
you
can read
everything
it.
that's on there. I'm going to be reading to you everything that's on here anyway, because I know some folks are a step away or haven't got the ability to see it. The questions about people that we look at are who will be affected by whatever we are considering, and what will it take for them to lead the direction that we take? So again, who will be affected by whatever we are considering, and what will it take for them to lead the direction that we take? This is very different than how most of us make decisions in our organizations. In our organizations, the leadership team may make decisions, or you may make decisions about your program. When you're doing strategic planning, the board may get together and make decisions. You may have 20, 30 people in a room while you're making decisions about what you're going to do, which is what we think of as normal. Again, the assumptions that go into our actions, we think that's normal. But I live in a community of 1 million people. So if 20 or 30 people are making a decision in our organization, or I'm a program manager and I'm making the decision about this program, I'm making a decision that's going to affect potentially 1 million people. That's incremental right there. That's incremental right there. And so that beautiful battle cry that began with the disability rights movement of nothing about us without us. We are making decisions all the time that affect all of those people. It is why the question is, who will be affected by whatever we are considering, and what will it take for them to lead the direction we take? I can give you an example. I can give you a bunch of examples. We did a demonstration project with a food bank in the past couple of years, and this was during COVID. And they decided that they wanted to follow these questions. They really, really wanted to engage their community as deeply as possible, and that whatever the community thought was important, the food bank would be in charge of implementing that. So they would take their direction from the community. It was during COVID, so it was a lot slower than it could have been otherwise. They talked with all of their staff. It was a very large food bank, so it was about 120 people. They talked with all of their staff, and they asked their staff, who will be affected by this? That question, who would be affected, so they could go talk to them. They talked to all of their partner agencies and had their partner agencies bring all of the clients that worked through those partner agencies. And they had these conversations over and over again. The conversations were not, what is the problem? How do you think we should address it? The problems were, the questions were, I'm sorry, what do you aspire to for the community? What would good look like in the community? And we'll talk about those questions next. But they were the catalytic thinking questions. And they asked basically the same questions they would have asked in a strategic planning session with 20 people. They asked that to their entire community. And again, this was during COVID, so it took a while. It took probably a little bit over a year. By the time they were done, they had more ideas for actions than they could possibly deal with. And so they said, we need to figure out a way to prioritize this. They again went back to their community. And during COVID, again, during COVID, 100 people came out, sat outside masked, and helped the organization, helped the food bank prioritize which actions they should take. And then the food bank's job was to put that into action. We did the same thing at Creating the Future a couple of years ago. Several of you may have been involved in that. We were at a turning point for our organization to say, what's next for our organization? And we took several months to create a community engagement plan, and we asked our entire community. Now, we're not local like the food bank, we're global. So it was all via Zoom, it was all via written, it was all via creating online communities. And over the course of 3 or 4 months, our community told us what they saw as the benefit of our work, what they thought was possible, what they saw as the people who would be affected by our work. And our job has been over the past couple of years and continues to be to put what they told us is important, to put that into action, which is completely different. That is the opposite of incremental. Because when we just work inside of our own selves, we are literally being in, it's the opposite of inclusive. It's exclusive. We don't think of ourselves as exclusive. But if we're not including, we're excluding. It also is, interestingly, Vu, the direct path to unintended consequences is when we don't ask the people who will be affected how they'll be affected. We always look up when there's unintended consequences and go, oh, wow, we couldn't have known that. Well, yeah, we could have if we'd have asked people. So just that one set of questions about people of who will be affected and what would it take for them to lead the direction. Think about movements. Who will be affected are all of the people, and what will it take for them to lead the direction? They do. There's no president and CEO of Black Lives Matter. There's no president and CEO of what's going on college campuses right now. That's who will be affected, and what will it take for them to lead?
I'm glad you brought up the college campuses, because that seems to be a movement that has been spreading, and students are speaking up against genocide. And it has been really amazing, one, to see just this movement spread and how effective it has been. And also, it's devastating to see the response to it, of just how much all these people in power just kind of just want to tighten their grip on power and to maintain the status quo. And I'm kind of astonished by it all. I'm inspired, I'm astonished, I'm kind of scared by like what is going on right now. What can we learn from this movement, Hildy?
It is beautiful to watch. It is persistent. And if you think about if one single or several organizations were doing this instead of thousands and hundreds and thousands of millions of students around the world, but think about two organizations got together or 20 organizations got together. And we got the same kind of rubber bullets, tear gas attacks, only the way we do that with organizations is we try and shut them down and et cetera. Again, what you were talking about before in terms of organizational survival, we'd say, oh no, we can't ask those questions. We can't step into this because they'll take away our C3, our tax exemption, or our donors will be pissed at us. Again, what's happening can only happen because hundreds of thousands of students are coming together and saying, we know this is going to suck and we're going to do it anyway. In organizations, we are so conservative and so about sustaining the organization that we say, we know this is going to suck and therefore we're not going to do it.
Do you think we're like reaching this sort of crossroad? Because I feel like a lot of the students are not, I mean, they're protesting genocide that's being committed by Israel against Palestinians. But I feel like it's also a protest against their voices not being heard for decades. I mean, we've been talking about gun control. We've been talking about like this untenable economic system where the students feel like they just don't really have much of a future moving forward. They can't afford a house anymore. They can barely afford rent. And maybe we're at this crossroad where the nonprofit sector, like, we need to be understanding of this existential crisis that the entire world is in right now. Because otherwise, I kind of feel like we either become like a scapegoat or like a fig leaf where people are like, oh, nothing is wrong. Like, look at all these amazing nonprofits. Look at all the cool stuff that they're doing. So obviously, things are not that bad when we have so many amazing nonprofits. I feel like in some ways, we've become complicit without realizing it. We're like advancing these terrible issues because people turn to us and then they become complacent about changing the systems.
Yeah, well, COVID changed things. And what was interesting during COVID is we all said we can't go back to the way things were. But the minute things opened up, because there was no alternative to go to, we all went back to the way things were. And now, 2 years out, I am seeing everywhere people asking these exact questions. They're saying, okay, now we need to find something different. Okay, we got out of the house and now we're back at work and we're back in community. But there is definitely an existential drumbeat to within this sector, globally, again, to say, okay, we said we can't go back, and now we really need to rethink. And I'm seeing it everywhere. I'm seeing it in terms of we need to rethink human resources. We need to rethink how we do strategy. We need to rethink how we fund, how we resource, how we think. And hopefully these questions can help with that.
So okay, let's talk some more about catalytic thinking because I want to hear like, all right, so you talk about some of the questions about people
About people,
you have.
about
What's the
people.
next thing that we need to do? What's the next step?
The next one, and let me just make sure I've got the right slide queued up.
People can see the slides.
The next questions are all about purpose, which is all about where we aim. And so those questions really are, what do we really want is the ultimate result of our work in the community? What do we really want? What would good look like in the community? What would the community look like when we say, mission accomplished, we are done, we do not need to be here anymore? Those are the questions about purpose. And what's so interesting is that we all, if you've been through a strategic planning meeting, you have asked these questions at the beginning. These are the quote vision questions, and they're an exercise that we do at the beginning. And then we say, okay, now let's get down to reality. And so we just ignore them. This is why we exist, and we ignore them, and we get down and we say, okay, so what do we think we can accomplish in the next 2 years? This is the biggest place where we get stuck, and it is where the conservatives said, okay, if that's the goal, that's where we're going, and if it takes us 40 years, we'll get there. The assumption here is that aiming big is unrealistic. And we've all been taught that. It's blue sky thinking. Okay, that's very, very nice, Hildy, but we've got our mortgage to pay. We got to get the rent. We got to get, If we do not aim at what is possible, we are guaranteed not to hit it. And so the best way that I have found to show what that looks like is using grade school math. And what I have pulled up on the slide here is what we learned in grade school is that minus one, zero, and plus one, that if we eliminate something negative, we don't get a positive. What we get is zero. So if we eliminate homelessness, if we eliminate poverty, if we eliminate substance abuse, we don't get healthy, vibrant, fabulous community. No, we get stasis. And even further than that, and so we've told ourselves that what good would look like is getting to stasis, is eliminating the problem. But the reality is that we'll say, and you'll hear this again because we don't believe that aiming big is realistic. We'll say, well, we'll never eliminate poverty. The line that we hear all the time, the poor will always be among us. We'll never completely eliminate substance abuse. And so we'll aim to reduce substance abuse by 20% on X side of town, et cetera, and et cetera, and et cetera. And so what we're really saying is we're at minus five and we'll be totally good if we get to minus two. We will celebrate if we get to minus two. We're not even aiming at zero. And dear God, we are not aiming at an equitable, powerful, thriving, humane community. And it really all depends on where we aim. There's this wonderful quote. I think I even created a slide of it. I like it so much. Where's my Michelangelo was always quoted as saying, the greatest danger for most of us is not that our aim is too high and we miss it, but that it is too low and we reach it.
Wow, that is a smart turtle.
I always preferred Raphael, but that's okay. The greatest danger is not that we aim too high and we miss it, but that we aim too low and we reach it. And here's what we wind up doing. If we are aiming at what we really want, that plus one, not getting from minus one to zero, but if we're aiming at that positive state of what we really want, that humane, healthy community, we can't get there unless we solve our problems. And so we are absolutely solving our problems on the way to creating what we really want, but we're not conflating intervening with creating. And that's what we've started to do. What we have been telling ourselves is that less bad is the same as good. And if we can, and again, it is recognizing it, seeing it, and noticing it in your daily life. How often are we telling ourselves in our organizations that less bad is the same as good? I remember, Vu, this was several years ago. You're making me think about it now. Here in Arizona, there was a big, huge movement, and one organization that wanted to start a movement in Arizona to, and I am quoting this, reduce the dropout rate by 50%. And that was their big, hairy, audacious goal. We're going to reduce, and they were announcing it. It was in the newspapers. We are going to reduce the dropout rate by 50%. As like, how about everybody graduates from high school and or everybody is reaching their potential, or there is no dropout rate? Or I mean, it was so, when I said we're at minus five and we're like, we'd be totally good if we got to minus three. This was their goal. This was like announced statewide. You want to know where incrementalism comes from? That is, we don't aim for what we really want. We don't put the dominoes in place for what we really want. We react, we intervene, we aim low, and then we pat ourselves on the back for we achieved what we thought we did. You know, I am tired of getting letters from my food bank that says we fed more people last year. I don't want you to feed more people. I want you to feed nobody because nobody needs food. And you know, we keep patting ourselves on the back. We fed more people last year. That's what conservatives have done, Vu. They put those dominoes in place, saying that's where we're going. We're heading there, and we're going to put the dominoes in place to make it happen.
It's so pervasive. A colleague was telling me that they attended this like 50th year celebration for this homelessness organization. And you know, they were celebrating being around 50 years. And at the gala, one of the speakers, I think one of the board members, went up on stage and was like, "To another 50 years." And I think about this all the time because it seems like this is where our sector has been, right? We celebrate. This is like incrementalism, right? On a large scale, even at 50 years, let's do another 50 years of doing the same thing we've always done, but maybe slightly better with better technology or
Which
whatever.
is again, it's exactly Pepsi, it's exactly Coke, it's exactly any business. I want to, if I start a small business, I want to, you know, our only remaining in Tucson, our only remaining full service gas station, closed, sold a couple of months ago. And the reason it sold is that the dad who owned it, who started it 50 years ago, was aging. He's almost 90, and his son wasn't going to take it over. And he was so disappointed that his son wasn't going to take it over. That's what we build businesses for, that they'll be here forever. My son will take it over. My daughter will take it over. My stockholders will take it over, whatever. That is again how we're built. And like I said earlier, we are using systems and structures that are incapable of creating the kinds of change that we want to see.
So you've been talking about creating the future. It seems like, and you may disagree, but it seems like a lot of conservative right-wing movements have been creating the future, have been asking these questions, but kind of using different values for a long time, right? And
They're
what
asking
do you
some
think?
of them. They're asking some of the questions. They're asking the question that I just did, what do we really want? They're not asking Who will be affected by whatever we're about to decide, and what would it take for them to lead the decision? And here's how I know that is right now they're trying to take away your voting rights. Right now they are eliminating. So the exact opposite of who will be affected and what would it take for them to lead? That's voting. Who will be affected? The 360 million of us here in this in the United States. What would it take for us to lead? We all vote. But right now, part of their plan is because they know, and I don't know if you saw this, Vu, several years ago, there was one of the many lawsuits about voting rights at the Supreme Court, and the Republican attorney actually said the quiet part out loud. Actually said, yeah, but if we don't get this, Republicans will not win.
I remember that.
So I mean, that is part of their plan. So they're not asking that first question at all. They're not asking about the people. They're definitely asking about how do you aim, and they're definitely not asking the questions that I'll do next, which is all about resources.
Well, before we go to that, it seems like they are. I would say they are asking that question. They just don't really, they don't care.
There,
Right?
I don't think
They're
you
like,
see,
we
but.
don't, I don't, we don't care. We know that it's going to affect poor people. We know it's going to affect people of color, disabled people. We do not care because
But
what we
that's
want.
not the second half of the question. What would it take for the people who are affected to lead the direction we take? And that's the part of it. That's the important part. It's not just who will be affected. That's nice. We can ignore them. It's who will be affected and what will it take for them to lead the direction that we take, which is what the food bank did, which is what we did at Creating the Future, which is what movements do. And you know, I hate to say this, but the conservative movement is a movement. So it's just a whole bunch of people that got together asking that particular question.
Oh, okay. Let's go on to resources because that's a huge thing in our sector, right? Seems like we are very constrained by the lack of resources and the constant philosophies around who gets resources, how do we do it, who do we need to suck up to, treating donors like heroes, etc. And it's just becoming more and more gross and dissonant, I think, to what we're trying to do. So what is creating the future, this or catalytic thinking? Think about resources.
Scarcity is probably incrementalism gone wild. It is incrementalism on steroids. And again, this whole topic is inherited from the business world, you know, and from traditional charity. You go to the people who have money, you beg and you plead and you ask, please, please, can I have a little bit of it? Even though you stole it from me, can I have a little bit back? You know, here's the economics of it, and I'll share that all of these questions are rooted in science. They're rooted in you saw math. They're rooted in brain science. They're rooted in economics. Here's what economics teaches us, and I was an economics minor. Resources are not cash. We are told over and over again, and business world tells us that the only thing that matters is cash. And when we say we're doing resource development, we're equating that with cash. But the reality is that resources are not cash. Resources are real stuff. They're the stuff we need. They're cars, vehicles, office space, people. Those are real resources. Cash is something that we use to exchange what we have, which is our time and our labor, for what somebody else has, which is the stuff that we need. So cash is just a means of exchange. It's not a resource. The real resources, the vehicles, the office space, the people, those are all around us and they're easy to share. I can't share a dollar bill. I can give you a dollar bill, but I can't share the dollar bill. But I can share your car. I can share office space. No matter how big or small, no matter how wealthy or poor a location is, you've seen either a vacant storefront or you've seen people with cars. There is stuff everywhere. All that we have is easy to share. Cash is not. And so the question that winds up coming up for, and let me just pull this up on the screen here. The questions in catalytic thinking that we ask first is, what do we have to build upon? What do we need? And who in our community already has that? So we can share resources. Now, will we eventually need some cash? Yes, we'll need cash, but I guarantee you'll need less cash. And we can talk a little bit about our attitudes towards cash. But the questions about resources are, what do we need and who already has that? What do we have to build on, basically? We have assets ourselves. We have things that we could share with others, and others have things that they can share with us. You know, if you've got a, if you need a van for your after school program, and a senior center has a van for bringing seniors in the morning someplace, oh, we can share that van. We can share computers. The seniors are using it in the morning. The kids are using it after school. I mean, there's things that we have that we can share. And probably the easiest way for me to talk about that is, I mentioned earlier that in my time in this sector that I've founded several organizations. One of the organizations that my husband and I founded years ago was the first ever diaper bank. This was back in the late 90s. It came about through our holiday giving. We had collected a whole bunch of diapers to give to a crisis nursery here in Tucson. We did it with a radio station sitting in front of our office, and we thought it was just goofy. It was something fun to do. We knew that the crisis shelter needed diapers. We knew that another organization needed diapers. For those outside the US, nappies. And so we did a diaper drive. It was December. We called it the December Diaper Drive. We had a radio station sit in front of our office, and we collected 20,000 diapers. So, oh, okay, this is pretty cool. We're going to have to do this again next year. And so every year it grew and it grew and it grew. And we started doing diaper drives in all of the schools and all the major employers. And by 1998, we had collected 300,000 diapers, and they were all in our 800 square foot consulting office. That is Dimitri trying to do work. There's a picture on the screen right now of Dimitri sitting in the office, and his head and chest pop up among diapers upon diapers upon diapers upon diapers upon diapers. At that point, we realized that we needed to do something. We needed to build an organization that could distribute these diapers to folks, because we were still trying to be a consultant. We were still trying to do our business, and we were winding up spending all of this time collecting and distributing diapers. So what we decided to do was to look around town and say, okay, what does the diaper bank need? Again, the questions that I shared with you, what do we need, and who has that? Who's already doing it? The list included things like warehouse space. It included office space. It included trucks to transport the diapers, because where we collected 20,000 the first year, individual schools were now collecting 20,000 diapers. We needed distribution systems. We needed promotions. And it's the same list for any of your programs. Anything that any of you all are working on, there's stuff you need. Some of them are operational functions. Some of them are stuff, like we needed a warehouse. And so we started to ask, who already has that? A couple I can share with you. Warehouse space was an easy one to think about. And interestingly, our local food bank said, you know what? We're really not in a position right now where we can share office space, because everybody said, go to the food bank, go to the food bank. When we budgeted, it was probably going to cost us $40,000 to $60,000 a year to find an experienced warehouse person. Our community probably needed about 2 million diapers annually. For babies, for folks with disabilities, for the elderly. We needed warehouse space and racks and forklifts and insurance and an experienced warehouse person. And we budgeted maybe $40,000 to $60,000. When we partnered with an organization here in town, it was $15,000. It benefited them, it benefited us. One of the other things we needed was caseworkers. We're not caseworkers. We were consultants to nonprofits who happened to collect diapers, happened to tell the stories of what it really felt like and was like to live in poverty. And so we started to think, okay, do we need one caseworker? Do they need to be bilingual? Do they need to be trilingual? And we realized that we could work with existing organizations, that not only did that alleviate us having to do the work, but it was one less place people needed to qualify. So it was better for the people who actually got the diapers. We did the same thing with transportation. You know, how were we going to get the diapers from a school to the warehouse? So I've got a quiz question for you, Vu. Do you have any idea how many diapers you can fit in a Toyota
3,000.
Not even 1,500. I happen to know that. And I happen to know that because my mother had a Toyota Camry. And so we were going to need trucks. And so we said, who's already got trucks? And of course, there's courier services, there's UPS. There's 1 year it was a plumbing company. And that was delightfully ironic that a plumbing company was collecting the diapers. But you know, when we pulled it all together, it wound up that, and I've got a little bubble chart here. And again, if y'all are having trouble seeing it, we will share the slides with you. But if you take all of the various functions, and there were many, many more, there was promotion. We even shared our tax exemption in those early years. We did a fiscal sponsorship. Our job was to coordinate, was to tell the story, and to collect the diapers. And in the first few years that we ran the diaper bank, and again, this was in the very, very early 2000s, we collected and distributed 1 million diapers a year. We did a year-round education program, which was billboards and radio and public speaking, and our entire budget was $75,000. And so by sharing the resources and seeing that resources are the stuff we need and they're easy to share, we actually were building community because all of those people in all of those bubbles felt like they owned the diaper bank. We would get calls from from a guy on the warehouse floor, just a guy. Not the CEO, not the person in charge of the program. And he'd say, we're almost out of size sixes and those babies need diapers. Do we need to do a diaper drive? Because he was so committed. Everybody in that sphere felt that. Our United Way at one point told us, you couldn't kill the diaper bank now if you wanted to because the community wouldn't let you. And so that whole sense, we talk about it here as collective enoughness. Collective enoughness that together we have everything we need, that it's only on our own that we experience scarcity. When we do look for the cash, though, again, you know, we look so incrementally at the cash. If we were to put in our budgets what it really costs to run our organizations, why do we not? Why do we go to foundations and say, yeah, we're going to pay our people $30,000 and $40,000 a year? When I know that it takes 70 to 80,000 for people to feel comfortable in their world, why are we not putting 70 to $80,000 in for every position so that people can feel comfortable when they go to work? So again, that whole incremental approach to how we think of things, when we think of it as us alone versus we think of, oh, our resources are the entire community. What do we have that we can share?
And we've been seeing a lot of that during the pandemic, right? With all the mutual assistance that's been going on. We see in the students' movements now because they've been sharing resources and protecting one another. And you're right. I mean, listening to you talk, I feel like we have been put into these silos and we think that this is normal for us to be in silos competing with one another in this Hunger Games. But I think someone did bring up this really interesting question, which is like, isn't the diaper bank then an example of incrementalism? Because why do we even have diaper banks? Why can't people just have, like wages that are fair and they can actually buy their own diapers? So this holding to both things, where we have to, where we can address the issues, the current issues, while also working towards systemic change. And it seems like we've been so focused on like maybe one end of it in
Well,
some.
and you know, I'll share a couple of things. First of all, we haven't been part of the diaper bank for about 20 years now, so we are very good at building things and letting them go. and really did not know then what we know now. That said, you're right. We do need to hold both things. We need to, as I said earlier, we need to solve our problems to get to the humane world that we want. We always saw our job at the diaper bank as both those things. And again, we haven't been running it for a very, very, very long time. But we saw our job mostly as that public awareness piece so that people understood what actually puts people into poverty and crisis in the first place. That it's not those people on that side of town, but it could be your daughter who's leaving an abusive marriage. That people understood what it was really like to be, why don't they just use cloth was what we heard so often. And people were shocked to know that if you live in a high-end area, forget whether you like cloth or not, if you live in a high-end area, you can absolutely go to your daycare that you're paying lots of money for and say, I want Susie's diapers kept separate from Mary's next door. And they will do that. And they will change it and they'll save the dirty diapers for you, et cetera. If you are a low income at a lower income daycare, nah, you have to provide disposable diapers because they're not going to do that because they're all unsubsidized. And so subsidized daycare, it's all disposable. And people will go, oh, I didn't know. We saw our job at the diaper bank as how many times a day we could get people to say, I never thought of that. I never realized that. I never knew that. And that is what leads to the long-term change. So, I abbreviated just to talk about about how we resourced the diaper bank. But the reality is we always saw our goal as that plus one goal and that the diapers were something that was needed right now in order to get there. In part, and I know that there is now a movement to get diapers included into. I know that the diaper banks are included in the state budget in California to get diapers included in the safety nets because they're not. Many people do not know that in the US, diapers are not included. They're not even included in the Women, Infants, and Children program. WIC does not cover diapers. They'll cover formula. We used to joke and say they'll cover formula. They'll cover what goes in, but they won't cover what goes out. And so, in terms of a movement, it is about creating an economic system that is just and equitable and humane. And the one we're in right now is none of those things.
So we can talk about this for a while, but we're reaching the end of the webinar, and what then this was a lot. That was a lot for us to think about. What are some actions then? And maybe is that even the right question to ask? Right? Because we are
I
so
mean,
focused on like action. What can we do next? What can we do immediately?
well, we do want to know what to do because we humans are doing machines. First of all, is to recognize, and like I said, sometimes when once you see it, you can't unsee it. Recognize the degree to which we are incremental in who gets to make decisions. We are incremental in where we aim. We are incremental in how we think about resources. And we have the potential to be expansive and inclusive and visionary and sharing our resources. And so the first thing that I would encourage people to do is just recognize it, notice it. Every time you are encountering things, go, oh my gosh, that's incremental as well. Oh my gosh, we're only asking two people. We're only asking a focus group of five people what we should think about for 1 million people, for 2 million people. If you live in New York, 10 million people. Oh, we'll do a focus group and we'll bring in 20 people. Tick the tick box. So recognize it, notice it. The other thing is ask these questions. The questions that I shared with you, ask these questions. The beauty about questions, Vu, is that you don't need to have a position of authority to ask a question. Anybody can ask a question. We talk about that as leading from the middle. That anybody, you're in a staff meeting and you can feel everything getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And you can ask, who would be affected by this? Should we talk to them? You can ask, what would good look like in the community? I know we're talking about what good would look like here for our program, but what would good look like in the community? When people are talking about resources, we can say, do we really need to go get a grant for the van? Or can we find out who in our community has it? Is ask those different questions. Recognize it, ask the different questions. And a couple other things. This is really a practice. It's sort of like meditation is a practice. This is the practice of catalytic thinking. And anything that is new, we have to practice. You're not going to become a concert pianist because you watched Elton John for an hour on TV. You're going to have to practice, practice, practice if you want to be a concert pianist. And again, if we want to get more routine in these questions becoming the way that we be in our work, practice, take one of the questions that tickles you and practice with that every single day about something. You're planning your day. Okay, I'm going into a staff meeting. I'm going to take the question of who will be affected. I'm going to hold space for everybody that's going to be affected, no matter what comes up in the conversation, so that I can say, oh wow, it sounds like a lot of people would be affected by that. Maybe we can talk to them, or even if we're just holding space for them in the room. But practice with one of these questions every day about just something that's going on in your life. We're going to have dinner with my in-laws tonight. Okay, what do I want this dinner to make possible? Well, I'd like it to be calm and joyful and happy. And okay, what needs to be in place for that to happen? We can ask it about anything in our lives. And I guess the only other thing that I would suggest, if people are really interested, if you really would like to dig deeper into this stuff, we have self-paced classes, click and play classes at Creating the Futures website. And in, again, that spirit of together we have everything we need, they are all pay what you can. And so if all you can afford is a dollar, the class is yours. We're not charging for the classes to make money. Well, yeah, a little bit of money would be nice, but mostly we want to share the thinking. And so if you can afford a dollar, it's a dollar. If you can afford $99, it's $99. But taking the classes if you want to go deeper, but mostly just recognize how much incrementalism is at play in people, in resources, and in especially in where we aim, and start asking different questions.
Thanks so much, Hildy. And I just think about being angrier. Is that? I'm just so annoyed with everything right now. I'm just getting more and more impatient. And I appreciate what you're saying about like refocusing us on what kind of future we're trying to create and what are the questions that we need to ask that will lead us to this sort of future that we want. And I realize, yeah, we have been asking all the wrong questions, the incremental questions, like what can we do slightly better next year? How can we get 10% more in the budget next year? Can we serve 10% more people next year? And the following year is the same questions. How do we serve 10% more people versus how do we create the kind of society where everyone thrives and everyone is able to participate in democracy? And those are the questions that are way better for us to ask
Yeah.
as we go about doing this. But it's going to take a lot of deprogramming, right?
That's
We've
why
been
we've got to practice.
programmed. Yeah.
That's why we've got to practice. It's why we've got to practice. It's like changing anything. It's like changing the way you eat. You're not gonna, I watched a movie on diets and I lost 100 pounds by watching the movie on diets. No, you're gonna need to change the way you eat, and that sucks. But it's work. It's just work.
And so we can do that. I think so the first step is kind of like awareness of how all of these philosophies have been shaping us. I also do like looking at what other conservative movements have been doing so effectively, and now seeing how the students at Columbia and other campuses have been so effective, right? And also balancing movements with organizations, because I don't think you and I, or either one of us, are saying we need to throw out every single nonprofit and burn them all down or whatever, right? Or that incrementalism in itself can be horrific. I think there's still some times where we kind of need to be, okay, let's be plotting and strategic while we solve these systemic issues. We still need to help people. We still need to help 10% more people or whatever it is, right?
Yeah. Well, and you had commented a while back on something I had written about the fact that we start every strategic plan with data. That's another place where we go right into the incremental place. And because the only thing you can do with data is about the past. Data is not about the future, because I have no data on the future. And if you have data on the future, I'd like to know about it. There is no data on the future. So all we can do it with data is react to it. And reacting is by nature incremental. And so we have so many of these systems that, again, our assumptions create our actions because our assumptions are we must have the data before we can move forward. No, we need data in service to the future that we want to create. We need to first define what is the future we want to create? What is the path we're going to take to get to that future, that beautiful, humane society? What is the path we're going to take to that? And what data do we, what do we need to know in order to get there? Not what do we need to know about the past that created the present that sucks. What do we need to know about what it'll take to create the future that we want? And so it's again, we're so steeped in those assumptions and they force incrementalism.
Oh, okay. We might need to do a part two on this, Hildy.
I'm good. You know me, I'll talk about this all day long.
But in the meanwhile, we do have like 10 minutes, so I would love just to answer any questions that you all have. So please put them in the chat, or I guess on Twitter. Actually, no, let's not. I can't stand
Are
Twitter.
people asking questions? No one's asking questions on Twitter.
No one's asking questions
Well,
on
we've
Twitter.
got comments. We've got comments. We don't have questions.
Right. While we still have Hildy out here.
I'll ask you a question, and then I will share with folks. I'm going to share a couple of resources that occurred to me afterwards. So we'll follow up when we share the recording. We'll also share the recording in audio also if you want to listen to it in the car or while you're working out. The one thing that two things. One, if y'all have questions as you're thinking about this, I have a tendency to absorb stuff, and then I'm in the shower usually when I think of the question I should have asked 2 hours ago. Shoot either Vu or me an email. Actually, don't shoot via Vu an email. I don't look at his emails; they pile up too much. Just shoot me
Sure.
an
Send me a DM instead, which I'll
email.
forward to Hildy.
I send Vu emails and then I text him and I say, I sent you an email. but shoot me an email, either info at creating the future or Hildy, Hildy at creating the future. And if it's something that I can answer in a quick
Dot
question,
com, right? Hildy or dot org?
no, it's .org.
Okay.
We're .org. But my question for you, Vu, is you have been on Creating the Futures for a board for a long time. What is it about the work that we're doing that tickles you enough to be on the board?
I really appreciate the framing that we have, because I feel like so much of my work has been angry ranting about the existing past and the current. And I think what I appreciate is just this sort of optimistic look at what we can actually do together. And one of the most profound things that you said to me a while ago was, like, how do we that we tend to be incremental in thinking about like our budget and growing 10% 1 year and another 10% another year. And that means serving 500 clients this year and 550 the next year and so on, 600 the following year, 610 or whatever. And you said, but why don't we think about, 20 years in the future when we've created this perfect society? What would that, and then work backwards. So the work backwards has been really profound for me. Like, what is the kind of society we want to create, and how do we work backward from there? Because that's how we plan stuff, right? We plan galas that way, right? We think about this is our gala day. What do we need to do a week before the gala, 3 weeks, a month, 8 months, or whatever? But, and that's completely normal, and it's a great thing to do, great exercise. And so to apply this to everything in society, what is the kind of society we want? Well, we have universal basic income. We have universal health care. Everyone can vote. Our elected officials look like the communities that they are in, rich people paying their fair share of taxes, and so on. And I think about how do we work backward from that. So it's been really helpful just to be involved with Creating the Future and other folks who are on the board and who are thinking the same way. So I've been very grateful to have the opportunity to just to hang out with you. But also, I get to visit you and we get to go to the desert and rant about things. It's been really fun.
Scream at the saguaros. Scream at the saguaros. I know that there was a question about holding space for both the immediate and the eventual, and And the duality, the supposed duality, it's not a duality, it's a continuum. If this last domino is creating that humane, healthy, equitable community in a humane, healthy, equitable world, and we say, what needs to happen in order for that to happen? What needs to happen in order for that next thing to happen? What needs to happen in order for that to happen? And we work our way backwards, just like you were saying we do to prepare for a gala. That first thing, that very, very first domino may be we need to help people who are hurting now. So it's not an either or. It's not a duality. It is a continuum. We need to help people who are hurting now while we are also working on creating the world that we do want. We are real good at reacting to what we don't want. And we need to really practice aiming at what we do want. And stop telling ourselves it's a pipe dream. Stop telling ourselves it's impossible. You know, we love visionaries. We love to put Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela and Gandhi, we love to put them up on the wall in our boardrooms. We just don't like them very much in person. We call them names, we call them Pollyannas. I mean, I titled my last book The Pollyanna Principles because I was tired of if you're going to keep calling me a Pollyanna, I'm going to claim it. I'm going to name it. But you know, we love visionaries when we want to just put their name and quote them under our email, but we don't want them on our board. We don't want them, you know, the board members looking at oh God, it's Hildy. She's just going to go back off about what do we really want? But we got to deal with reality. Well, it's not a duality. It's not either or. It's we got to deal with both things at the same time, or otherwise we will never even get to zero on that math line. We will forget never getting to plus one. We will just absolutely be in that place of we're at minus five, and oh, this year we're going to get to minus four.
I love that. Let's end on that because I feel like we need to reclaim our imagination, right? And we haven't. I think about like the defund the police movement. Right now, the police budgets are ridiculous. They're like 10 or 100 times more than education or housing or anything, and we think of it as normal. And when the movement to sort of like defund that and move that towards community solutions, a lot of people in our own sector have been like, well, no, we can't do that. That's just, and I just want us to get back to the space where we can have our imagination, where we can focus on our vision. So maybe that's what we need to end on. The mission is great, but we do need to focus on our vision. What is the kind of world we're trying to, what is the vision for this world we're trying to do? And it can't just be a name only.
We
So
need
let's get back to that.
to see our vision as an achievable goal and not as a pipe dream. We need to see our vision for the community as an achievable goal. And once we rejigger our minds to see that, anything is possible.
Thank you so much, Hildy.
Thank
And
you.
thank you so much, everyone. I know we threw out a lot of concepts and things to you all and for you to think about. We appreciate you. And yeah, thank you for all that you all do. I mean, our sector is definitely not perfect by any means. We do have a lot of challenges. And at the same time, I do want to acknowledge that there's just brilliant people doing incredible work all the time in our sector. Many of whom are in this chat or in this webinar right now. And I'm just always grateful for you all. So thank you. And we
Thank
look
you.
forward to seeing you again soon. I think we're going to try to send out the chat to everyone as well as Hildy's slides. And
Yep. And
I appreciate
a
everyone.
couple other this's and that's that I've been thinking about as we've been talking that we'll include in a bunch of stuff.
Yep. Looking forward.
Thank you all.
Bye, everyone. Aw, Kathy said, I have never been more inspired without simultaneously feeling exhausted before in my life.
Wonderful.
That's, I
Wonderful.
thank you, Kathy. We appreciate that.
Oh.